This is planning and land use. All the members are here. Comprehensive plan amendment. Over you.
Cool. So we're bringing the housing element to you on Monday for discussion. No final decisions are going to be made. The Planning Commission is actually talking about this again tonight. And so we'll have more feedback for you on Monday. The housing element calls itself, or we call it, the most personal element of the comprehensive plan. And as we were writing it, we kind of, that is true in many ways, where when we went to the Planning Commission, we were telling them that the housing element requires that we have an inventory of housing, existing housing, that we show that we have capacity for the future, that we have some demographic information that shows what sorts of people are living in these housing types, how are we expecting it to change, and so on and so forth. And so the Planning Commission had a really interesting discussion where invariably with housing elements, you find, well, invariably with everything, you go to where maybe the drama is. You want to tell a story a little bit, and where there's conflict or where there's struggle. So in our first version of the housing element, we noted that in Ferndale, as Ferndale keeps growing, our housing prices keep increasing, and we have a significant number of people who are middle class or even sometimes upper middle class who are doing reasonably well and don't need all that much help from government. You see that the average income in Ferndale is higher than the state or national averages, which is good. But then you also see that the number of people, or the percentage of people living under the poverty line, is also higher than the state or the federal average. So what you end up having in Ferndale is increasing stratification, where you have folks who are doing just fine, thank you, and then you have more and more people who are living beneath that poverty line, who are really struggling. So we brought that to the Planning Commission and pointed out, gosh, there are some inequities here that probably, as we get more dense, it's going to increase. That generally, if you have more multifamily units, you are going to have more people living under the poverty line. And it's not necessarily that multifamily generates poverty. It's that folks who can't afford anything else might tend to go into multifamily or mobile home parks and things like that. So the Planning Commission had an interesting response, and it's going to come out as a little bit negative, and I don't think that they intended it to be, but they said, gosh, this draft really focuses a lot on those at-risk populations, the elderly and the poor, when the majority of the people in Ferndale are still, again, doing quite fine, and that more attention should be focused on that majority of people, rather than kind of giving the false impression or the impression that Ferndale's housing really struggles. So what we've done is we've gone back and I personally believe that we need to talk about those issues, that the inequities are important, and that they're going to, even if the folks that are doing just fine, thank you, aren't that affected by it now, as we grow, as we get more dense, that will start to affect folks, where more of our resources or more of the community's resources are going to need to be spent to help those folks that aren't. Whether it's the government doing that or not is just kind of a fact, or we're going to be in more of a walled city. So rather than saying, oh, Ferndale's going to struggle or Ferndale's struggling, or really concentrating on that divide, what we sought to do was to say, as a general policy for the city, no matter who you are, when you live in Ferndale, there are eight different kind of values that we would expect that everyone's going to have access to. And that's kind of the linchpin of what we're proposing for the housing element, is that we're going to make sure that we have adequate land for all different types of housing.
Which page are you on? I apologize.
I am on page 18 of the document, of the packet, page 4 of the housing element.
Thank you.
So adequate land, for all types of different housing, whether it's multifamily or single family, that we're gonna have capacity. This is more in our capital facilities element where we're gonna have water and sewer capacity, park capacity, that sort of thing. That single family detached is gonna continue to be the predominant form of housing. This is a big deal kind of where Bellingham has set policies saying that, in fact, I'm gonna get the percentage wrong, but something like 60% of their future growth is gonna be in the form of multifamily development over the next 20 years. And that's raised a lot of concerns and for realtors and others who say the demand for single family is still gonna be there. And by coming up with that policy, Bellingham, you're pushing people out to Linden and Ferndale and the unincorporated county. So by us saying that single family will continue to be the predominant form here, I think that we're protecting that. We do have the capacity for it, but we are also evolving where right now we are closer to about 70% of our housing is single family. We're expecting it's going to get down to about 60%, and that as we'll talk about in just a couple minutes, there's a lot of different forms of housing that aren't really being built
yet. Do we allow ADUs now in ours?
We don't, and so that's something that we're wanting to work on after the comprehensive plan, allowing ADUs, allowing different forms of infill, mixed use, and so we do spend a lot of time talking about what those different things are.
It'd be nice to be able to adapt some of the single family stuff. You know, for an elderly relative to be able to bring them in, or even just to have your kids be able to live there for a while until they...
Absolutely, and again, that's gonna be a big part of the second part of this, where we talk about where all those different housing types will fit in geographically, so that folks in the single family neighborhoods don't feel threatened that, oh my gosh, there's gonna be an apartment building in my neighborhood. There probably will be changes in those neighborhoods, duplexes or accessory dwelling units, if the CCNRs let them ultimately. But that way people can age in place, or you can have a teenager that continues to live with you as they go through college, or what have you. That as part of our values, we are going to be tracking demographic trends to measure the statistics and changes over time, where we can't simply say, oh, we think that we're going to get older as we go forward, and we don't measure it, because it might be that we have an influx of young people. And if we continue to plan for our population getting older and it doesn't happen, we're just kind of throwing money away where it's not needed. So being able to track that over time and kind of keep measuring.
That, where would you get that data?
Where would we get it? Through American Community Survey, which is U.S. Census. Comes out every year, every 2 years, and so you can see that. So it's a check-in on census data.
And if you haven't had a chance to play around with it, it's a pretty cool tool online. You can get lots of fun information out of it.
Could you send the link to council?
Will do.
And I would anticipate that in this document, we will also include some of those links, such as in our goals and policies. I would think that we would have goals and policies for each of these different values, and then we would include in there, goal measure, demographic trends, policies, use this data.
Okay.
So it's fairly consistent. Flexibility for different lot sizes, densities, housing choices, land use mix, accessory dwelling units, and design configurations, where we still have some prescriptive measures of development, obviously, but that we do allow for that flexibility, so that, for example, if we should have a development that comes in that's requesting a planned unit development, maybe different, varying from some of our basic code requirements, that we might say, gosh, you know what, this does actually serve a need, and that maybe we can consider some additional flexibility within prescribed boundaries. Maybe it's not reducing the width of the streets, but maybe it's allowing them to have that mix of uses or other things. Housing choice, regardless of income. So when we can say that we know that folks living in multifamily are lower income, or that folks that live in manufactured homes are lower income, or that only that the only people that live in single family detached are higher income, that's not really a sign of a healthy community. It doesn't necessarily mean that folks below the poverty line are going to be living in a 5,000 square foot house or driving, you know, a Cadillac Escalade. But it does mean that we say, gosh, you know, Whatcom's Gadget Housing puts people into single family units, that multifamily, there might be some active retirees that live in multifamily or condos or whatever the next version of condos are going to be, so that we try to avoid going into those stereotypes as much as possible. And we integrate into our different codes ways where we don't say, oh, we know that because this is a single family development, it's not going to need this, or because it's multifamily development, it will need this. Sense of place. One of the things that we've heard from the community is, all right, Ferndale's growing fast. I reluctantly accept that, or I embrace it, you know, whatever, but don't turn us into Everett. Don't turn us into what we're seeing in, you know, the outskirts of Bellingham. We need to keep what's Ferndale. So how do you do that? What we're arguing is that we don't say precisely how you do that, because then you end up having a cookie cutter development where you try to create a theme or a false sense of what may have been, and it kind of turns Disney-fied and it's not authentic. So there are...
See Leavenworth.
Or see Leavenworth, see Winthrop. But I think that there are a lot of ways where we can, development by development, work with applicants. A good example, I think, is either Mariana's or Gabriella's plat that we had last year, where the Gardner home, which is one of the two oldest homes along Vista, it was built in 1909, could have been removed and they would have gotten an additional lot out of it. But then you have just homes in that area that were built in the last 20 years, and you lose some of that sense of place and that history. So we worked with the applicant on our lot averaging, where they were able to retain that home and get the lots that they were looking for. There another good example is in the Gardner subdivision just behind it, where they made use of a depression in the land, and they were able to turn that into a water feature that is a big pond, and that's what defines that whole neighborhood in many ways, is you can walk around the pond, there are ducks, you know, it's like the make way for ducklings, they have their own little island there. But for the city, as development comes in, to allow the land to kind of speak for itself and to ask those questions, you know, what if anything are you doing to distinguish this development? And maybe it's nothing. And then last, active living environments, where the city's role as a small city isn't to socially engineer to say, you must have a jungle gym and you must have this, that, or the other thing. But the city's role is more to say, we're going to make sure that through our park impact fees and through our Parks Recreation Trails Master Plan, all or the vast majority of our residents are going to be in relatively close proximity to a trail that's going to then give them access to a park. That single family units should have yards, and that multifamily shouldn't just be your building and then the parking lot. That there be either the access to the trail where people can exercise, or that they have something there themselves. And that's something that the Growth Management Act requires, is that there be methods for active living environments. What we're also wanting to do is talk about urban agriculture in this as well, where...
You mean like chickens?
Not necessarily chickens, but not excluding them. Active living in environments. Gardening itself is a huge... it is a form of exercise. Out of it, you get healthy food. You also, if you're growing, you learn different responsibilities. And if it's a community garden, you learn, you know, cooperation, things like that. It's become increasingly popular. And so what we're saying is not you must install a community garden or you must install a garden or anything like that, but that we would in the future work on things where we would acknowledge that these exist and don't give people the impression that they are living in sort of a gray area where they have a black market honeybee nest, or that they have a greenhouse that they need to hide. So that's something that a lot of jurisdictions are doing to varying degrees of success.
Is this just, are you talking about doing a code change or giving, if someone has a pod that they're putting together, you would give them points for having an area where you would have a community garden, or?
Well, potentially both, or potentially neither. What we found that we're lacking sometimes in our existing code is any acknowledgement that a garden can exist. So you do have folks, especially we have a lot of different cultures that are coming in where that's what they do, is they garden, they grow their own food, or a fair percentage of it. Maybe they have bees, but the bees, because they're located here, are more of a nuisance, whereas if they were located here, aren't a nuisance. And so we're seeing a lot of conflicts sometimes, and we're wanting to bring that into the light a little bit more so that we can enforce, and also so that we can say, no, you're good to go. You do this and you're good to go. Okay. The demographics themselves are straightforward. I mean, they're the numbers. They are what they are. But if we go down later in the document, what we've really found was...
Can you show page numbers when you
go? Yeah, so looking at page number 41 of the packet is where we begin. And actually, maybe
it's page
up a little bit, yeah. Let's start
page
with
38?
Page 38. Good. Thank you. So this is the next major part of it, where we have identified kind of general areas, you know, not sub areas, not neighborhoods, whatever, but where we talk about infill development, fringe area, downtown development. I think there's one other that I'm not remembering, where we say in our residential areas, here are our existing neighborhoods, our existing single family neighborhoods, and here are the types of developments that you're likely to see there. Single family is an obvious one, but then getting into things like accessory dwelling units. What is an accessory dwelling unit? What could it look like? What are some of the qualities that you might find there? What is a zero lot line? What's a duplex? What we're finding is that we don't have much expectation, as we've said, that the community is necessarily going to read through this. But having these cut sheets enables us to provide on social media or on our website quick answers to common questions. It allows us to kind of be more portable if we are presenting to a community group, or if there is a subdivision or a development that's proposed that includes some of these things, we can speak more knowledgeably about it. Also, a lot of our developers aren't really aware of these things. And we've talked about this a little bit in the past, where in Ferndale up to this point, our building community is Jim Unruh, it's Bill Kramer, it's other folks who make their bread and butter on a specific type of development. And they don't get rich doing it, but they earn their salary and they earn their worker salary. And so Bill Kramer has been building
the same house
for the last 40 years. And talking to Bill about what a single family attached is or how a duplex could fit in is scary for him, but it's also eye-opening for him too. And Ryan, who I believe is his grandson, it's interesting seeing the internal workings, because Ryan is talking about efficiency, environmental efficiency. He's talking about these new building materials, And Bill, you know, has sometimes said, oh gosh, you know, that's the younger generation, you know, and I'm about to hand it off to them. But talking about what these different things are to our builders, sometimes they say, I had no idea that Ferndale would allow something like that because I thought Ferndale only wanted single family. No, we've only approved single family because that's what's been applied for. And then getting into other areas of the city where new development, kind of the same area as our infill development, but these are the vacant parcels in Ferndale. What sort of development would we expect to see in new subdivisions? Well, conventional single family subdivisions, differentiating that from planned unit developments and what those might bring, different mixes of uses, different densities, more open space, possibly smaller lot sizes. Cottage housing is something that maybe we're ready for, but the local developers aren't, where that's not necessarily subdividing, but it's creating a cluster of houses typically around a shared common area.
You mean, is that, would that be Correll Park or Commons?
Correll Park is pretty close to it. I think Ferndale Village Homes at Thornton and Malloy is going to be another. It's a subdivision, but it has all of that in it. And then we start talking about the fringe area, where so far we've been talking about the single family areas, where when you really look at the housing types that, that we're proposing, there is going to be some NIMBY, some not in my backyard because it's new development. But overall, I think objectively, these aren't the types of developments that are shocking or jarring to folks. These are ones that can typically integrate into those existing neighborhoods. It's a change, it might be more dense, but it's not that you're all of a sudden having 40 houses break or anything like that.
Do we have to use the word fringe?
No, we don't.
I don't know, it just bugs me, like they're out there on the fringes.
Right.
But not really part of the city, maybe perimeters or some other word though. I can't think of another word right now. Just
from adjacent.
I'm thinking outline, but that also kind of is none of us.
Well, you've already identified earlier in the document that there's already some problematic, you know, issues with development in the Portway area, right? Yeah. So then you go and call it fringe.
It's the fringe.
All of a sudden, you know.
Yeah.
Satellite.
Unclean. That doesn't sound
good. Border.
Border. Well, and it's kind of a transition area where
transition.
It is. It's a transition area like between that. Single family and our dense core, where the downtown core.
And it's also a transition between, at least in some areas, between city limits and unincorporated county.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Different zones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So here you're likely to see a mix of the uses in both the denser areas and the less dense areas. Townhouses where it keeps a lot of the architectural styles possibly of single family, but it brings in the densities of multifamily. And it can do so often in such a way that it doesn't expand the bulk too much, where they're generally smaller units. Triplex and fourplex, this has been the bread and butter of multifamily development in Ferndale. And it is typically what we are seeing in that transition area. I mean, just right here, I see Jim Unruh's fourplex, and then we have Woodside Villas, which are up off of Lego.
Can you just, what is the difference between, like, if you had four townhouses together versus a fourplex, legally, what is the difference between that?
Well, and Rebecca might be able to speak as knowledgeably or more knowledgeably, but generally, the townhouses allow you to own that, allow you to get into the market, whereas the others, you're purely renting. You can just rent townhouses too, but.
But even with a zero lot line fourplex, that's, you're still, you can't own that, one of those.
Well, you wouldn't do, a townhouse can, the same building can be a lot of different land ownership underneath, and so that's the main difference in ownership possibility.
Okay.
So if you do zero lot line where you cut the piece of dirt, so then you can purchase just your piece of townhouse with the dirt.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you can do one piece of dirt and then do a condo. So you could still own your piece of building, but it's a shared piece of ground. Or you could do a fourplex style where one person owns and rents it all out.
Okay.
So it could be the same looking building.
Right. Yeah, I haven't thought that townhouses came with land. that you owned. A condo, you have common ownership of the land. Is it that simple? No?
Corral Commons has a townhouse.
It is.
Really?
One row, they're
really?
Owner-occupied okay. Townhouses.
Yeah, that sounds
the
like
term townhouse, as far as my evolved. Profession, is used for a lot of different, it's a style, like a two-story
yeah.
or a one-story.
Right, yeah. You know? Yeah.
And talking to some Canadian developers, they have their own, you know, definitions too.
There's a lot of town homes, they look like town homes. Once you cross the border, a lot of
yeah.
those
yeah.
things all, and they're actually tearing down old houses and turning into a bunch of town homes.
Yeah.
But do we want to encourage town homes because that's ownership, or do you want to also have fourplexes because you need them? Or is that not something the city should really either?
It's ultimately up to them. Where a good example is Siddle. This is Vista Meadows. Those remain one underlying lot. So they're fourplexes, they're rentals, but they're built as townhomes. So there's a building code issue too, where each unit is its own structure. From the foundation all the way through the roof.
So those are rentals. People don't own those townhomes.
Correct. However, Ron York, who's the developer, wanted to put a number of elements in place so if he found that the market was transitioning, he could go and he could subdivide them into townhomes.
Mm-hmm. So he built them so that if he wants to sell them individually, he can.
Yeah.
Okay.
That they have their own meters or their own ability to have the meters. They are independently, you know, constructed, even though they look very much from the outside as a multifamily to be. So
is that something you want to incentivize others to do, or is that something you just let the market deal with?
I would think that it's something that we would let the market deal with, where if, again, it provides that flexibility, there might be people who are entering into the housing market there and maybe they have more financial means to then purchase. And if they're living next to the adjacent unit that's pure rentals, that's probably a good thing, because then you have that mix in there as well without anyone knowing and saying, oh, those are the rental areas. It's a mix. Those are rental, but those are owned.
I'm just thinking from a council viewpoint, do we want to incentivize certain things because that's what we want to see? Or are you comfortable that the market's going to give us the multifamily stuff that we need?
I think you're still getting the same density either way, so
whether it's rental or
mm-hmm. that's what we want.
We then start to see some things like live work where we haven't seen this yet, but increasingly in more urban areas, and maybe we're 20 years out from this, but maybe we're only 5 years out, because we have had some applicants kind of float this idea of you know, anything from the traditional I live above my shop sort of thing to I actually create something, not that people living above their shop don't create stuff, but I have a 3D printer downstairs and I do almost a quasi-industrial, you know, sort of thing where it doesn't have any impacts on anyone else, but I don't need a whole bunch of space for a big office. Let me just be downstairs and have a studio apartment upstairs. And more than likely what we would see is something that's in the form of a fourplex or a fiveplex where they do have some common resources. Maybe they have a couple of extra parking spots for their customers in this fringe area, but it looks like a residence, or maybe it looks like a sort of hybrid. So actually, we are seeing this over at the corner of Eaton and Second. Sean Hegstead is a local architect, and he's not moving there, but what he's going to have is his architectural office, another office, and then studio apartments on top, where the idea is that in that second space, that person might live on top. It's one of those things where it probably is not impactful, and we could design codes. This doesn't permit them. It just says there's a possibility. We could design codes to say, yeah, we'll allow those. If it meets these certain requirements.
Would it need certain zoning? I mean, I'm assuming that you wouldn't do that in the middle of our neighborhood.
Correct.
Right, yeah.
And there we would be looking like in possibly our mixed use commercial area, or if we evolve from there where along Portal, we might see more and more people who say, gosh, it doesn't make much sense for me to put only a commercial space there. But if I'm also living there, I'm gonna save money, I'm gonna be able to incubate myself a little bit so that I can expand in the future, which then leads us to allowing kind of more of those entrepreneurs to get a toehold, become successful, and then it expand over time.
Does the National Building Code allow that, or is that something we would have to change?
No, it allows it. It looks for the most protected use to have a protected route of travel outside. So if you live up top, you can't go through your office to get outside, but you'd have two separate entrances, more or less.
It's kind of a push-pull, and there's a balance between social engineering saying we only want 5 acres and a house, or we only want apartments, versus the idea that is it government's job to decide what kind of houses go where? So what you end up doing is, hopefully, is that you encourage a wide variety of housing types in your comprehensive plan, but in your zoning code, you say these type of uses are compatible here, those type of uses are compatible there. So that way you don't end up with, if this is indeed a bad thing, single family home, eightplex. And that might not be a bad thing, but that's where government gets to kind of social engineer, is through the zoning code, because you're literally saying this use can be next to this use, but it can't be next to this other use.
Right.
But in a comprehensive plan, you want to be as broad, as inclusive as you can, mother-in-law apartments, live work. You want to encourage all those things, because we are not market makers, but we are in the sense of zoning. If we didn't allow anything but single family homes, that's all we would get. But is that all we should get? And that's where you guys come in to decide that balance between the carrot and the stick, if you will.
For example, if I was to open up a studio art gallery teaching facility, and above there would be an apartment, mm-hmm. could I have visiting instructors stay overnight, not actually live there, but utilize it for out of town?
Sure. Probably not in a single family zone, but a transition area or downtown, where then you do get that. We're expecting these areas to be more 18-hour-a-day areas where there's people living and working there. Whereas in a single family, 7 o'clock at night, people are starting to kind of retire to bed and it gets quieter.
Well, in our neighborhood.
Now, the Pacific Islands is nuts at night.
My house. Drag races, baby.
Right.
My house, we go to bed.
That's after the dinner.
That's after the
sunset. Cheap dinner.
And then we transition into the downtown core, where, again, we're gradually getting closer and we're gradually getting higher, where we want to keep the downtown core as its separate kind of space, its separate feeling. And so it would have some uses that are unique to that core. That way we don't have downtown bleeding out into other areas, where you go to downtown for a little bit different feeling. And I think that that's something that's hugely important for Ferndale, is that, again, we'll accept growth as long as our single family characters evolve, but don't radically transform. And as long as we can protect, as we cross over the river, our downtown core, where we'll accept a box store on the east side of the river, we'll accept, the retail and stuff. But when we go into downtown, it should have a different mix of uses from any other area.
Streets are you? I can't see the streets on the map.
Yeah.
So what are you considering downtown core? Because it looks like you're going
up
on the other
bit.
Side of the, yeah.
And so that is intentional a little bit, because what Greg said is we want to allow the zones to further define it, but so it would not be inconsistent with the comp plan, but perhaps you say, gosh, we disagree that this zone should extend up here. But what this is showing is our traditional downtown area, going a little bit more to the west, but then also jumping over the railroad tracks and including Griffintown as well.
So it's going right up to where that orangish color?
Correct.
Sand.
Which is the urban residential zone right now, which does allow that kind of
And how far west are you going? You're going over back, basically toward whatever that other color is.
We're not going too much further than where we go now. We're going, I was going to move the mouse over there, I guess I can't.
I saw you trying.
Right? Yeah. Why would I do that?
Someday.
Yeah, going up to Washington a little bit more, extending that possibility outwards. It was talked about a couple years ago. As we know with the floodplain issues, as Greg says, you grow north. I mean, you know, so generally growing north and west, possibly.
I like the idea. Do we want to change the map and start calling that downtown core, or is that just really more of a zoning map?
That is a zoning map.
I'm wondering if you could create a map and then have like another little dotted line so everyone knows what downtown core is.
We would probably do something like that for the web version of the comp plan.
Yeah, you can even have one of those little pullouts where you enlarge the downtown core, so you now have the. But you need to be careful in your comp plan to not be absolutely specific, because let's say you wanted to, for whatever reasons, expand the downtown core from a zoning standpoint.
Consider it all the way to church, maybe.
If your comp plan had a defined area, you would have to change your comp plan first before you change your zoning. But if you talked in a little more amorphic state about what downtown is, the characteristics of downtown, then you could ebb and flow the boundaries, the exact boundaries of downtown, without having to wait to go back and revise your comprehensive plan.
So is it okay just to have it in the pink then? Are we not doing that?
I think that this, or even a less jagged shape, would be good. Because then we never want the comp plan to stand in the way of a good decision. And sometimes that happens when it's overly prescriptive, where we say, well, the comp plan doesn't allow us to allow San Bulos to put in a fully funded whatever, even if everybody agrees it's the best thing in the world.
Aren't you opening up confusion if you have two different diagrams of the same thing?
I think that if we make this more blurry. I mean, unfortunately, you know,
just
it's
a little bit out of
a
generic area.
Say,
just do a circle in the generic kind of area. Yeah.
It's in here somewhere.
Yeah. It's in here somewhere.
Yeah. Somewhere in this general vicinity is downtownish.
And then in downtown, we talk about mixed use. We talk about greater density, so on and so forth. And then we wrap it up. We try to put more visuals in here where we can convey ideas without really.
That looks just like Ferndale.
I'm sorry?
That looks just like Ferndale. A little mountain in the back.
It is Ferndale.
It is. The Three Sisters.
The Three Sisters.
Exactly.
Nailed it.
but without plugging this into a very specific program. This says active living environments. Here's generally what we're looking at, and we're going to let our other programs that follow this succeed or fail.
We're going to get some skinnier people who run.
Hey, they're Ferndale fit.
Yeah, I did kind of stretch them a little bit. So that's more or less what I have. We're going to have a presentation on Monday. No final decisions, looking at recommendations so we can take it back to the Planning Commission. So any concerns you have, I know there are a couple other agenda items, so.
Just like on Monday, let us know what you need. I mean, if there's two or three things you need from us, let us know. Because again, it's 71 pages.
Right.
And it was riveting.
Cool. I will.
You doing the update?
You're doing great.
No.
I'm remaining silent.
Yeah. I wanted to say that. I really like the graphic nature of this so much better than the old page after page after page of just words.
I do.
Yeah.
Especially the housing inventory analysis, all those extra things.
That's a good enhancement.
And nice job. We've been playing with some web tools about collapsible text we can make it so you just kind of get the headlines. And then if you're like, I want more information, whoosh.
Click on the last word and it opens up.
Yeah.
Thing.
Yeah. So.
Cool. Who's doing update on Slater?
Yeah, well, the next item, in fact, the next two items were brought forward by Teresa and Rebecca. So I figured we'd kind of start off by getting an idea of the topics from you guys.
Okay. Well, I would say there's obviously a history that I am unaware of because I'm new, and some of the prior option plans as far as the roundabouts I saw when I was on planning commission, but I knew there was discussion and nothing had been decided and there were issues. So when I met with Kirk, he had said there was somewhat of a verbal agreement with the last mayor towards the end of the year, last year, and then nothing has happened and they're kind of waiting for a mutual decision. So he had hoped to have a joint meeting with both councils. I'm not sure why he didn't go to you directly with that information, but
who's Kirk? Kirk who?
Planning interim planning director for Lummi Nation.
Does he have a last name?
Binish.
Okay.
Did you guys talk about what the joint meeting would cover as far as topics?
Yes, he wanted the engineers who have designed the existing roundabout plan to come and give a presentation on what the final plan is on their
parametrics
and why parametrics.
Parametrics. Okay.
And then have some discussion between the two groups.
Right.
You mean, are we talking about the Lummi Indian Business Council and our council? Those are two councils?
Okay. Because right now, got a whole bunch of these, so hopefully there's enough. Did 10 of them. This is subject to change.
Maybe but hopefully not.
Yeah, this is the legislature, as you guys are aware, have allocated some monies under the Connecting Washington program. And this was as of, you can see up at the top, this is as of March 7th. And even though things move slowly in Olympia, sometimes things move rapidly in Olympia. And so this list, and this is just one of, well, you can see on the bottom, 5 of 56. There's 56 pages of the Connecting Washington project statewide. And they go into different, they're into different program categories. And up on top, you can see that it says Highway Improvement Program I. And the only reason that why that's important is that the I program, and literally it goes, I think, from A to Z, but the I program are monies that go to DOT for projects either on the freeway or projects that span jurisdictions or corridor projects, which is what we're talking about here. So as you can see on here, and again, this is subject to change, but this is what the current thought is as far as the monies to Slater from the state and the timing of those monies. And you can see that it's $21.1 million. The first $2 million comes in the 2019 to 21 biennium, and then another 8.9 in 21 to 23, another $10 million in the 23 to 25. So should this iteration, and this is exactly what last year's, it's strange, you think that last year when they put together the Connecting Washington program, which the state sells bonds, I think this is like a 10 or, well, it goes all the way up to 2031. So this is the state's plan to fund projects statewide all the way out to 2031. Another way to say that is it won't be until after 2031 that the state could conceivably come up with another transportation package. We didn't do it earlier, but that's how the way this is envisioned. So the timing of this money is what was envisioned and what was awarded last year in 2015. So if you would have saw this sheet in 2015, it would have been the same dollars in the same timing category columns. So the I program, so starting in 2019, $2 million will go to DOT to start the design of the Slater improvements. And then in 2021, 2023, the rest of the money comes in theoretically to pay for the project as it's constructed. So currently, and I visited a little bit with DOT, their plan is to, in 2019, when that first $2 million comes down, is to start a design process, and they do this statewide, to decide exactly what the improvements down at Slater will be. So in that case, in some ways, we really probably need to wait until 2019 to have DOT decide what those improvements should be. We've talked about in our transportation plan a series of roundabouts. In fact, what is funded in this is 5 roundabouts. One at Slater, 2 on either, one on either side of the freeway, 1 at Pacific Highway, and then 1 all the way out at the Guide.
Northwest.
So this 21.1 is intended to fund that entire, those all 5 of those corridor projects. So what would happen is come 2019, DOT would engage the local folks and start planning for the roundabouts there. So in some ways, talking about it now is kind of premature, and I don't know what we would talk about now, because the monies don't come to DOT until 2019.
Why were we doing the IJR though? Because we were doing the IJR last year, so why did that start so early?
That's a little that's a variant off of this. If these monies do come in these time frame, mm-hmm. and they do come to DOT, DOT won't do an IJR, not because they're DOT, but because the improvements that they envision wouldn't require an IJR.
Better explain maybe an IJR.
Yeah, the only time you need to do an IJR.
Say what an IJR is.
And an IJR is an interchange justification report. It used to be called something else, who cares? But the key for the IJR is the J, the justification. Because when you think about it, when you have the interstate system, I've even seen these signs mostly over in eastern Washington, entering a limited access highway. Hmm. And I remember as a kid going, what the heck is a limited access? Well, it's just that. There are only so many ways to get on and off a freeway, as opposed to our streets where we have, streets coming in all the time. So the purpose of the interstate system is not to get folks from Main Street to Portal. It's to get people from California to Washington. It's an interstate system. And so the feds are very protective of the interstate system, most notably what's considered called breaks in access. That is anything that accesses I-5, because anytime you get more accesses, you cut down on the speed that's allowed, you cut down on the mobility, you limit the freight and people moving from one place to another. Almost like there's a reason why subways are so efficient, because you get onto the subway and it doesn't stop until it gets to the next station. The more stations you have, the longer the subway takes to get there, the more breaks there are. So on every interstate highway, there's a little invisible right-of-way line that parallels. So in here is federal highway jurisdiction. So the feds control not only the interstate system, but on each side of it. If you want to break access, if you want to put something that goes across this area here, you have to justify it, because it's not supposed to be done. Theoretically, you're supposed to do it with caution, with a lot of thought. So only when you want to break access do you have to do an IJR. So if you have an overpass and you want to widen it, you're not breaking access. The access is already there. If you have an on-off ramp that you want to make longer, you're not breaking access, you're making it better. If you want to add a new, Smith would be a good, if we wanted to put on-off ramps at Smith, we would have to do an IGR, because we would be breaking access or crossing over this invisible threshold in multiple locations. So many or most interstate projects don't need an IJR, because you're just building the overpass wider, you're improving the ramp, you're putting those ramp lights, the ramp meters on. None of those things break access, so you don't need an IJR. So right now, down at Slater, if all we did was to build the 5 roundabouts, 1 at Rural, 1 on either side of the freeway, 1 at Pacific Highway, and 1 out at Northwest, if we do that, or if DOT does that, no IJR would be required, because they're not breaking access. You're simply taking a stop-controlled
on-off ramp and turning it into a roundabout. And realize, remember, you know, here's that invisible line. We can do whatever we want out here. It's outside of Fed jurisdiction, so no IGR would be required. So if we put a huge roundabout in rural, no IGR, and whatever we do at Pacific Highway, whatever we would at Northwest, no IGR. So the only time that you would need an IGR for Slater is if you break access. And what happened was the Lummi Nation desired to break access because they wanted to, usually, you have a four-legged roundabout, the on-ramp, the off-ramp, and then the east-west section of Slater. Their idea was to put a fifth, which would lead onto their land from the off-ramp, and it breaks access. That, and only that, required an IJR. So if you don't do it, no IJR is required. Come 2019, DOT will start planning for these five roundabouts, single roundabout, double roundabout, whatever.
Kirk said that the fifth leg would go into the Cope Road.
It still breaks, they're still between, yeah, let's do.
Right, it is breaking access.
Exactly.
Going into
here's Cope.
Is this it? Is this the one?
I was trying to turn. And here's that, that.
It doesn't
that.
Rotate.
Okay.
Hey, Greg.
And
you
here's
got the map
this.
Right below you, the actual map?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, Cope is here, so the fifth leg could conceivably go as easily as here to here.
Great. You're southwest.
Okay.
You're up south.
Oh, I am.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me stand over here. The fifth leg would cross Cope. Could cross Cope here. It could go here. Whatever way. If but here is that. There's that line. Actually, for here, it's more of a. It's not a straight line like I simplified over there. So going across here would break access. Whether it linked up with Cope or whether Cope went away, it would still break access. So it's not the linkage with Cope that triggered an IJR. It's the physical crossing of the federal DOT right of way that necessitated the IJR.
But we own Cope Road.
Yes.
So if we don't want it.
Yes. Yeah, we control Cope Road. And if we told DOT that we were not interested in any connection to Cope Road, they would say, okay, fine. I mean, they're not going to force us to do something we don't want to do. It's our right of way. It's our road.
I'm curious. You said Kirk said he had an agreement with Gary.
He said they had come to some verbal agreement.
But Gary wouldn't make an agreement with him. Or is he inferring the tribal council?
Possibly. I don't know.
You aware of anything like that?
Greg and Gary met with Tim and Kirk.
Yeah, we've been meeting with a lot of folks over, not here in probably the last year or so. The issue is, comes back down to that fifth leg. When Gary was here and the discussions or when the IGR was ongoing, the team that was assembled, DOT, Federal Highways, the county, the city, the port, the county, WTA was a big group. In fact, we're doing one for Bakerview right now. That group that's assembled, you start brainstorming. Well, what if we build this? What if we build this? What if we build this? What if this is this high? What if it's wider? What if it's skinnier? And you start coming up with, I think there were probably 10 or 12 options as to what size the roundabouts could be, whether there was a fifth leg or a fourth leg or whatever like that. And then you start winnowing them down. Again, the only option that was that fifth leg that would require an IJR. The problem became when Parametrics, the engineering firm that the Lummies had employed, when they come up with, and we're all familiar with the level of service, level of service and probably more detail than you need. Usually we talk about A, B, C, D, E, F for a level of service. For roundabouts, it doesn't quite work that way. It's a thing called the volume to the capacity, the VC ratio. A VC ratio of one means the volume of the traffic equals the capacity of the roundabout. So anything over one is bad, anything less than one is good. But you can have there's a rough translation between the VC ratio and the ABCDEF. So when Parametrics did their analysis of all the different alternatives and the level of service, what ended up happening, a lot of transportation planning is kind of esoteric, but this makes a lot of sense. If you have only four legs on any roundabout, physically, only so many cars will be in the roundabout at any one time. If you have five legs or six legs or seven legs, mathematically, more cars can be in the same space at the same time. It just makes sense. So what the analysis that Parametrics did showed was that with the fifth leg option, the level of service on the on-off ramp went down to level of service D. So what happened is that the fifth leg brought the level of service for this on-off ramp below what we consider to be an acceptable level of service. The fifth leg harmed the interstate, because if you have an accident or you have congestion at the on-off ramps, you have traffic that backs up onto the freeway, which is extremely dangerous and just not a good thing to do. So the city wrote a letter to the governor, and we said that we are not in favor of the fifth leg, because the fifth leg inappropriately channels more traffic onto the interstate system instead of off. If you only have four legs here, the level of service here drops. Our opinion was it's more appropriate, it's better for the interstate system and for the citizens of the state of Washington to have a local intersection suffer, if you will, than the interstate system suffer. So because it's almost like that balloon, you squeeze it, it's gotta come out somewhere. Because all of the traffic, I mean, this is what's driving the traffic, you know, the Lummi development. And they either have to come through this roundabout, or with the fifth leg, they come this way. If you don't have the fifth leg, more traffic is into this roundabout and the level of service goes down.
Down to what?
And I have the sheets, I'll pass them out. The leg going into the development goes to F, the others stay pretty good. So the leg going into the development would suffer, but all the legs on the interstate on-off ramps would not.
So these estimates, though, assume mostly car traffic, is that correct?
True.
So what's out there right now is that Lummi is looking at doing a truck stop. So now we're pumping through a whole bunch more, much larger vehicles trying to make their way through these roundabouts. That's not considered into these grading systems, is that correct?
No, in fact, we had some issues early on because think about it this way. If I tell you there's going to be five vehicle trips, the impact is... If I say there's going to be 15 vehicle trips, the impact is higher. If I say there's going to be 115 vehicle trips, the impact is even higher.
This is PM peak.
Right. My opinion was that we were studying, these aren't the right numbers, but we were studying 15 vehicle trips when in fact, in my opinion and others, we should have been studying much higher. Put it another way, the amount of development that was folded into the IJR, when they said, okay, how much are we going to develop? How many trips are we going to generate? In my mind, it was artificially lower than what it should have been. So I think all of the level of service numbers were less than what they should have been. Early on in the process, the city of Ferndale's point was, we're not studying the right problem. We're only studying 75%, 50% of the problem.
The assumptions are off.
Now, obviously, when you get to F, you can get worse than F.
I mean, there's F plus, whatever you want to call it.
Bellingham.
Bellingham. Bellingham. Bellingham. Bellingham, exactly. Some people say, well, once it's Main failed, Street. It's failed. No, no. There's a difference between sitting up with two lights and sitting there for five lights cycles.
John Wanda. I think this is far. I was the only one on council my first 2 years ever, Brent, because I think you came after my first 2 years, you weren't there. But we spent dozens of meetings talking about level service. And it mm-hmm. came down to, I think we adopted a level service C.
Right.
And we could have gone F, but mm-hmm. to make it simple, F meant lower impact fees. F meant it was easier for developers to come in. Because we had people whining and dining me and say, don't you dare do level C because it makes it too costly for us. This is what they were telling us, that for developers to come in level C, I don't know if we believe that, I don't think we did, but we adopted a level service C after a tremendous amount of discussion and debate because we thought, you know, we don't want to just look like Bank of You during rush hour or the Guide Meridian during a rush hour. So the council at the time was very strong that this is important, that our level of service of traffic is important to the city, important to the community, important to the traffic, the whole thing. So I think what Greg is talking about here is really important, that what we're trying to hear is defend our traffic, a reasonable traffic. If you want to be like everybody else, go to level F. You can just do that. But that's kind of what he's talking about here.
Doesn't the state, isn't there, I mean, we can't do new construction in anticipated level F. Isn't that correct?
You could. DOT has a level of service of D.
Even okay. onto the freeway, if you're backing up onto the freeway?
Yeah. What ends up, you have to think about the reality. Technically, if you have, let's say you have a level of service C or you have a level of service D, technically and theoretically, which is never reality, once you get to D, you stop. You say, no more development. Well, DOT, statewide, and no city I know of statewide, is willing to say, we're full. Thank you very much. Yeah, no one else can build a house. No one else can build a store. We're full. We're as congested as we're going to be. What ends up happening is you gulp hard and you can drive up and down I-5 and you see level of service Fs. Baker View in the city of Elk.
That's an M.
Yeah, exactly.
So you want that.
So you try to plan for the best, but in reality, unless you're willing to say, sorry, we're full.
Well, Carol had a question too.
Is a 15-year plan.
Yes.
What was I-5 Slater on the previous 15 years?
It was exactly those numbers and exactly that timing. So in 2015, Slater was awarded the 21.1. In 2016, it didn't change. There was
2014 and
it didn't exist in 2000. This program didn't exist in 2014. Okay. In 2015, they created the Connecting Washington program.
And the funding source, what's CW stand for?
Connecting Washington.
Okay. Yeah.
As you can see, there's multiple funding sources.
Right. Well, the gas tax.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. The gas tax increase. The state's going to sell bonds and then pay for the bonds through the gas tax over the next 15 or so years, probably more than that.
We need to wrap this up.
So long story short, the only reason in my mind would for us to engage in conversations now with DOT or anyone would be because of that fifth leg. If the fifth leg is indeed harmful to the interstate and is not considered to be an optimum or a preferred alternative, then we simply wait until 2019. When the money comes to DOT, they'll go through a planning process and build the roundabouts. So I think need to relax and wait until 2019.
I think needs to be clarified. Maybe I'm not trying to insult anybody, but if you're new, somebody else can't make an agreement with the mayor. It has to be with all seven of us. So to say that you made an agreement with the mayor, you might have had something you wanted to bring forward, but unless the mayor brings it forward, we can't. And the only one who says yes is the body of seven.
Just for a contract.
I think what happened, and Greg was there. I think Mayor Jensen and Chairman Blue did meet and felt like they made some progress in a certain direction. But I don't think either. Certainly, our council didn't look at it, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I believe their council was not entirely pleased with it, my impression from the mayor. Right. I'd rather have him speak for himself.
Yeah, again, Gary and Tim's met separately, and only the two of them quite often. And so what I'm saying now is really just kind of secondhand. It was my impression that, I think both of them perhaps thought that there could be something worked out, and I don't know what that is, that the city would all of a sudden say to DOT and Federal Highways, you know, that fifth leg, we're okay with it now. Let's start the IJR process up again, because it stopped back in last July is when it stopped, because we objected to the fifth leg and the harm that was going to be caused to the interstate. And the real one of the rationales is that fifth leg is going to have to cross not only DOT but then go on to Cope Road, and our position was that's not an appropriate use of our right of way. If indeed we're causing some safety considerations, bad safety considerations for the interstate.
I know we have to move on. Was that any of that helpful?
One of the diagrams that Kirk had showed the roundabout that would be where the light is now at Rural, and how large that roundabout would have to be to actually accommodate all the traffic. And it would seem like that would make us reconsider the potential fifth leg, if that could relieve that one almost ridiculous looking sized roundabout that went into three lanes at one point. And I don't see the harm of meeting them and discussing it if there is new information that I haven't heard, that the rest of us new people haven't heard. And
I think the concern was that a lot of the policy people weren't sitting there, the people that have to make the decision on this. And so to have a meeting between the councils, and it's not like a decision-making meeting, it's more of an informative meeting, is from what I gathered. Mm-hmm. And having the engineers kind of explain these things.
Yeah. My concern, and others have perhaps heard this, or most of you have not, is that going back to what I said originally, when the numbers we were studying were, in my mind, artificially deflated, I think we're not studying the right problem. We're only studying part of the problem. So my concern is that the conclusions that Parametrics have come up with, or their recommendations, have been driven by bad baseline information and a desire to promote a fifth leg into a development. It's just, I don't think, in fact, I said this at the very first IJR meeting 2 years ago, that we're not studying the right problem, and you can't get the right solution if you don't study the right problem. Parametrics will say what they will say, but I have little faith in the results, because I've seen repeatedly where they've said one thing, we've brought up some issues, and it's just wrong. But I mean, if you all want to meet, that's fine. That's absolutely, just realize that the only reason why we need an IJR is the fifth leg. And the fifth leg harms the interstate, and I don't think that's what we should be in favor of. If Rural and Slater becomes a much larger roundabout, that's, I think, more appropriate than harming the interstate system. But again, that's, you guys are the policymakers, so it's up to you.
And DOT doesn't take a political position on these matters, but we met with DOT about a month and a half ago, and they're not thrilled with the fifth leg. This is not something they would advocate or push for. They're not going to advocate breaking in the right of way there. So
I wouldn't be in favor of the fifth leg either. I don't want to do anything at the interchange. I'm really uncomfortable with the fifth leg at the interchange, because we see what happens at Porter Way, people backing up onto the freeways, and if you're going to make a truck stop, it's just going to be dangerous. I mean, we can talk about, if you want to do something different with Rural, then maybe we talk about shifting rural around or something, but I could never be in favor of fifth leg.
I'm in the same place. Yeah, I think that that's become such an important arterial both for the Lummi Nation, but also for Ferndale, that we really need to get that entire interchange right. And you know, assuming right off the bat a D, even with bad information, you know, inappropriate assumptions, you can easily see that becoming an F interchange from the day that it opens. And I think ultimately that makes both the City of Ferndale and the Lummi Union Business Council and all the people involved look like fools if we turn that into a guide meridian.
So, last point, one of the things that the suppressed traffic numbers showed is that there was not a potential need to widen the overpass.
If we just did the four?
With the fifth. The parametrics, their idea was a fifth leg, but not widening the overpass over I-5 because the traffic numbers weren't big enough. And my contention was, well, the traffic numbers are not big enough because we're not studying the full build out of Sailor's Village.
Didn't we just hear you can't even get a third lane? You can't even get a third turn lane over that. Is that right? We were talking about this yesterday.
If you look at it, Smith's a lot wider than Axton and Slater, because Smith was built for on-off ramps. Bakerview, they restriped it to get that extra lane in. Mm-hmm. Well, you can't do that at Slater. Physically, it's not big enough to restripe.
You can't even get a third lane.
So you can't even get a third lane by restriping. So one of the bigger issues, and this is a cost issue as well, is you have to widen that overpass. Four legs, five legs, roundabouts, traffic lights. I think if we really study all of the development potential in that area down there, it's going to become quite apparent that widening the overpass is critical, but that was not included.
But that was included in the conversation I had, that they were discussing widening.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say real quickly, if I could, I'm not comfortable at this date of two councils meeting. But what if, is it Kurt?
Kurt.
He's welcome to come to this committee, because he's shared with you and shared with you. He's certainly welcome to do that. Would that be something we could start in that direction?
Sure.
You certainly can hear from him.
But I don't know, public works or planning, probably. You're right. Planning probably.
Do both, you know. But
it's
up to him. I just sense it's time for two councils to meet. We had some of those meetings 5-6 years ago, in reflection, I don't think it's time to do that yet. Thank you.
Any motions?
No.
No? I guess we're adjourned.
Thank you for your interest.